I did that for 3 years. So I remember vividly the day I got the call and they said, we have a show for you. And so I asked them what it was and they said, it's Melrose 90210, right? They say you start Monday. And that's how it started.
Wow. Okay. So what did you end up doing on that show?
Sound effects editing.
Okay. And what did that involve exactly?
Okay, so let me kind of explain that process. So
that was I know. I'm just thinking for like all the people who don't really know what's involved in all this.
Right. So that was in 1995.
Yeah.
And technology was a little bit different. We were still on 2-inch 24-track tape. And we had like a 4-track Synclavier, which at that time was was the best digital workstation. But it only had 4 channels.
Welcome to Audio Branding, the hidden gem of marketing. Sound plays a more important role in human behavior and our decision-making than you may realize. In this podcast, I'll help you understand the art and science of sound so you can better influence others in business and your life. I'm your host, Jody Krangle. Let's delve a little deeper. Here's the first part of my conversation with Kenneth Johnson. My next guest is an award-winning supervising sound designer whose groundbreaking work has shaped the sound of some of television and film's most iconic projects, including Netflix's hit series Forever and Kevin Hart's animated comedy Lil' Kev. Born and raised in South Central Los Angeles, he rose through the ranks of Hollywood post-production, breaking barriers as one of the few Black sound designers in the industry, and earning multiple MPSE Golden Reel Awards and Emmy nominations along the way. Today, he's not only redefining sonic storytelling, but also championing greater diversity behind the scenes, ensuring the voices shaping what we hear are as dynamic as the stories themselves. His name is Kenneth Johnson, and in this episode, you'll discover how he transforms silence into emotion, creates sound for the impossible, and builds powerful storytelling through every note, tone, and texture. As always, if you have questions for my guest, you're welcome to reach out through the links in the show notes. If you have questions for me, visit audiobrandingpodcast.com, where you'll find a lot of ways to get in touch. Plus, subscribing to the newsletter will let you know when the new podcasts are available, along with other interesting bits of audio-related news. And if you're getting some value from listening, the best ways to show your support are to share this podcast with a friend and leave an honest review. Both those things really help, and I'd love to feature your review on future podcasts. You can leave one either in written or in voice format from the podcast's main page. I would so appreciate that. And now, here's my conversation with Kenneth Johnson. Welcome, Ken. Thank you so much for taking the time to talk with me today. I'm looking forward to this.
Hi, Jody. Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure.
So I usually start by asking you if you have an early memory of how sound moved you. Do you have one of those?
Yeah, I think when I think of sound, I mean, originally I got sort of interested in music because I came from a musical background. And so I grew up in the housing projects in South Central, and I would, late at night or early evening to late at night, we would kind of walk down the street and there would be guys who were harmonizing like in 4 or 5 part harmony. And so I was really intrigued at how that blended. How they made those voices blend. And so that was my first, I think, interest in how sound comes together to create something.
Sure. Yeah. So the harmonies, I guess, would have been, that's great. That's a great way to,
Sorry. Yeah, they had some. That's okay. Yeah, they had some amazing singers that, unfortunately, most of them didn't make it, to the big stage, but they were very talented. And so we were mesmerized by some of the vocal acuity that they possessed.
Sure. Was your family musical at all?
My brother plays keyboards, and we're the only two people that are musical.
Oh, okay. Okay.
Yeah.
So how did that segue then into what you're doing now? So you do sound design for film, is that correct?
And television.
And television, yeah. Mm-hmm. So how did you end up getting into that? Because that's got to be an interesting journey.
Yeah, well, what it was, so when I started getting interested in how sounds work, as I said, it was first with the vocal a cappella groups. And then I decided, you know, I was kind of caught up in like the gang life and, you know, things were not going in the direction that they should have been. And I one day just decided that I wanted to change my life, right? I didn't want to continue down the path that, you know, I was headed and my friends were headed. So I wanted to do something different. So I remember vividly one day I went and the guys were hanging out and something just came over me and I said, you know what, this is it, I'm kind of done. So I called my mom who lived not in the projects. And so I asked her, could I come live with her? And she said, yeah. And so once I moved in there, I had to make a decision as to what I wanted to do with the rest of my life, right? And so I say, you know, I've always liked music. And so I had to figure out, well, if I'm going to be in music, I can't sing, you know, unfortunately. So I said, well, what other instrument would I like to play? And I was always, you know, captivated by the sound of the bass guitar, right? So I said, you know, I want to be a bass player. And so what I did at that point, I saved up my money and I bought my first bass guitar and I started taking some lessons and sort of, you know, became a musician, right? And started local bands and, you know, entered some other bands that allowed me to travel abroad and stuff like that. And yeah, so that's how I originally started that. And then I got intrigued by the technical aspect of music because we would go into recording studios in my original band and we would, you know, lay down tracks for songs that we had written. And I would be watching like the engineer and he would be moving knobs and faders and compressors and doing all these things. And it was quite interesting to me. So much so that I decided I wanted to learn more about it. So I attended a couple of schools, the University of Sound Arts, which is now defunct, but graduated from there in recording engineering and music production. And then I went to Long Beach City College. They had a wonderful music program for engineering music. And I went there and I got a certificate there. And then I started working locally in studios as a recording engineer. Worked my way up to what they call a first engineer, which is like the top tier. And at that point, you know, I was doing okay, but I wasn't happy with like being the guy that got called for 12 o'clock sessions at night. And I was like, I'm not really feeling like staying up all night. So
that's a tough job. Yeah.
It was a really difficult job, you know?
Yeah. I work with a lot of audio engineers. The magic involved is, it's insane.
Yeah. I just didn't want to do that. So unfortunately at that time, my sister was a VP of production at Universal. My brother was a first assistant director. And so I called both of them up and I said, hey, you know, I'm really interested in sound for film and television. And I know that some of the same equipment that we use in music is being used in film and television. So they said, let us introduce you to some people. So it started out with my brother introducing me to Walter Anderson. He's a boom operator. And he had a mixer that he worked with. And they allowed me to come on set and sort of train as a cable guy and a second boom. So I liked that. I thought that was really interesting. But
that's
again,
a tough job too. Yeah. Wow, the boom operator? Yeah.
Yeah. That, you get kind of tired, you know, holding that thing up, right?
Yeah.
So I did that and I liked it, you know, but I didn't like the 16-hour days, right? I just had a newborn. And I was like, I don't really want to be away from home like that. And then they were talking about traveling and going out of the state. And I was like, there was a lot of temptation on the set that, you know, I know that my girlfriend at the time would not approve of. So I said, you know, I need to do something different. So at that point, I called my sister and I asked her, I said, well, can you direct me in any way? And she said, well, there's post-production. And I know a guy who is the senior vice president of Taddeo Studios. And let me introduce you to him. And his name was J.R. DeLange. So I met with J.R. and I was like, look, I really kind of want to see what this sound for film and television is about. And because I come from music and I mix music, I'd love to be a mixer mixing some of the soundtracks for the film and TV. So he said, well, that's great, but you can't come in and just sit in that chair. You've got to work your way up to that. So he said, we've got, you know, two positions that usually work their way up to being mixers, and that's a dialogue editor and a sound effects editor. And so I said, well, I don't really want to be a dialogue editor because that sounded to me a little boring, because it's more technical, a more technical challenge and problem solving. But I found sound effects related more to music because of the different layers of things that you had to create, whether it's the backgrounds or the sound effects, or if you're designing a spaceship or whatever, it's all colors, right? And that's how I look at it, as colors, sound colors, and that are stacked on upon each other to make a specific sound. So I said, well, yeah, I think sound effects is the way for me to go. So he said, well, let me put you in a weekend. We have a weekend class. Let me put you in there and see how you do. So I took the weekend class. Because I knew nothing about it, you know, I didn't do that great. And they didn't really go into really teaching you. They just sort of handed you this reel. And they said, well, let us see what you got.
Yeah, like, they just expect you to know. Yeah.
I was like, well, how do I start? Where do I start?
Sure. Right?
And yeah. So I didn't do very well with that. And so at the end of that, the guys who ran the class said, well, hey, we don't hire people who don't have experience. So you know, why don't you come back to us when you have some experience. So at that point, I went back upstairs because JR's office was upstairs. Went back upstairs and I said, okay, this is what they said. And he said, well, no. He said, I want you to go down and tell them that I want you to be able to come in and sit with an experienced editor and also be able to come in on the weekends and work on your craft. So I went back down, and of course, the people who told me to go away were not that thrilled that I was back, right?
Okay, like, well, yeah.
They were like, well, how'd this guy make it back? We just told him kind of like to scram, right?
Well, can I just say, like, the amazing results that your siblings are getting for you? Because, like, that's fantastic that both of your siblings would be in that kind of a position. Like,
fantastic. Yeah, I was fortunate, you know. I was very fortunate to have some connections because this business, you know, yes, you have to be talented, but this business really revolves around relationships.
Oh, well, you got to get your shot somehow, right?
Yeah, you got to have somebody that you know, likes you and someone mm-hmm. that wants to help you move ahead. And that's super important. You know, you got to have the talent, of course. So for 3 years, I came in the evenings and I sat with, you know, an experienced sound effects editor, and I asked questions. I tried not to be too intrusive because I knew he had deadlines, but I would just ask, you know, specific questions that I really wanted to get answered, and he was really nice. And then I would come in on the weekend, they would give me test reels, and I would work on those reels. So I did that for 3 years. So I remember vividly the day I got the call, and they said, we have a show for you. And so I asked them what it was, and they said, it's Melrose 90210, right? They say, you start Monday. And that's how it started.
Thanks for taking the time to listen. Quick question. Do you know anyone else who could benefit from hearing more about how powerful sound can be? If so, would you mind sharing this podcast with them? It would mean so much to me. Now, I'll stop interrupting and let you get back to the show.
Wow. Okay. So what did you end up doing on that show?
Sound effects editing.
Okay. And what did that involve exactly?
Okay. So let me kind of explain that process. So that
I know. I'm just thinking for like all the people who don't really know what's involved in all this.
Right. So that was in 1995.
Yeah.
And technology was a little bit different. We were still on 2-inch 24-track tape. And we had like a 4-track Synclavier, which at that time was was the best digital workstation, but it only had 4 channels coming out. So the first thing we would do is we would have to sit down and we would make a what we call a cue sheet. And what a cue sheet is really a roadmap, right? The layout. So we'd say, okay, we'll start with the backgrounds, which are like the ambiences and the wallas, like if you're in a restaurant, the people talking, or if you're on a street, like the traffic and the birds and all of those types of things or ambiences, those are called backgrounds. So you would start with that, and then we would start to build in the sound effects, which include like, and that show wasn't like, it was just a lot of door openings, a lot of doorbells, you know, some cars starts and outs and aways and driving sequences, you know, and stuff like that. So, yeah, that's kind of what that was.
I mean, it sounds like a lot of work and very precise.
Yes, it's very, you have to be very precise with it.
Absolutely. Yeah. I wanted to ask you what, if there were there any sounds that you had to make that were not sounds that had already been made?
Oh, absolutely. And that's really probably the most enjoyable part of being, you know, at that time we were still a sound editor, but now it's called sound designer. Mm-hmm. So, for instance, I did a show called Honey, I Shrunk the Kids.
Oh, I remember that.
Right.
Yeah.
With Rick Moranis.
Yeah.
So, you know, he was always, you know, he was an inventor. So they were always creating these contraptions and things like that. So those
no one's
things,
ever heard that sound before.
Yeah, those things don't exist, right?
Yeah.
So you kind of had to figure out in your mind, you'd have to say, well, what do I think it sounds like, right? Or what should it sound like? And then you start putting pieces together, right? You may get, you know, one thing might be a spring and one thing might be like a hiss sound, like you know, it could be a brake release. It could be a lot of different things depending on what the visual is, because you want to match the visual, right, with the auditory, right? And so, yeah, that is probably the most funnest part of the job is when you're creating something that does not exist and it's all in your imagination, right, and what you think it should sound like. And if you're lucky and if you're good, the people that you present it to will like it as well. You know,
that's so, always the key, isn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, because, you know, you can make it for yourself, but you got to make it so that other people like it too.
Yeah, yeah, of course. Yeah. Are there any sounds that you created in particular that you really are proud of? Like a particular new sound that you did for something that...
I mean, I've created just a lot, but I wouldn't say...
I'm sure there are a lot.
I wouldn't say that there's one that specifically stands out to me, you know.
Is it like saying you love one child more than the other?
Yeah, it's sort of like okay. That, you know. Yeah, it's sort of like that. I mean, I've created thousands of different sounds, thousands of different scenes. There's not one that really sticks out, with the exception, well, I did have to create it, but I created it so... Road to Perdition, right? The movie. So there's a scene in there where this little boy is trying to start and drive this car, right? And so I had to create that. And I thought that was a beautiful scene because it was like winter and it was snowing. And so I had to create all this lush sort of background that gave you the sense that it was really cold, right? And then... it was silent, right? It's very silent because, you know, when it's cold, there's really no
birds. Because of the blanket of snow, yeah.
Yeah, and there's no animals out. There's no birds out there in the cold, you know, making bird sounds. And so it's very quiet. And what that taught me was that quiet can be, you know, as effective as loud noises, right? So we started out with you just hearing the sound of, like, winter. And then he starts to... tries to start the car, and so the car is not really functioning, and he's having an issue starting it. And so that whole sequence of him trying to start the car and finally getting it started was just really beautiful. It sounded amazing, and it was actually, we had something where our peers sort of judge our work, right? And we show like a clip of a specific movie, and that particular clip was chosen, you know, to be shown to all the peers, our peers and stuff, because we were very proud of just how beautiful it sounded with the minimalist type of sound design.
Yeah. Congratulations. It's an achievement to be able to use silence as well as you can use sound. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
Because, you know, there are some things in some projects that you're just bombarded nonstop, right?
But wall of sound. Yeah.
But there is something to be said about simplicity and how effective that can be as well.
Yeah, totally. Was there another instance where silence really played a big part in something that you did sound design for?
Let me think about that.
So I know with Leverage, you made a lot of gadgets and such that needed sounds.
Those guys were always creating something. You know, and that was another one that was highly creative.
Do you ever work on commercials at all or anything like that?
You know, I've done, not really. I did an AT&T commercial. That was really the only commercial that I did. It paid really well. I would have loved it.
Advertising's good for that.
That was good money. You know, I'm certainly looking to get into that space. And so if you can hook me up, I'm willing to do it.
Well, I mean, hopefully people will hear you on this podcast. We get a lot of discussions happening with advertisers. So, of the point.
Yeah, because we've been kind of discussing, you know, because I'm really trying to expand my company, you know, because I'm here in Southern California and production is down. Well, production is down all over the United
States. It's down
States.
Everywhere.
It's down. So we're looking at other avenues, like I'm looking into gaming. You know, I want to look into some commercials and look into the ad space and try to figure out how to navigate that. So, we certainly have the skill set and experience to do that kind of work. It's just getting that opportunity.
Yeah, gaming would be a really good one because I know that the sound design that goes into that, plus the music, is getting top tier. Yeah. I mean, some of the stuff that I've seen in the last 3 years has been insane.
Yeah.
It's just been really good.
Yeah, it is. I just did so Sony PlayStation, I reached out to them and I just did a test for them for voiceover. And they're actually coming to the studio on Monday and tour. And also we also did a sound design test as well, where we took like this section of a Spider-Man game and we we recreated all those sounds. And so, you know, they gave me a couple of notes. I'm going to do those notes and try and get that back to them next week.
Okay. Yeah. Well, so, I wish you the best of luck with that, because that's that could be really big.
That would be big. I'm also just trying to figure out what's next. And, you know, last night I went to a vertical drama seminar and they were talking about the whole vertical movement. So I'm like, how can I apply my sound to verticals? And, you know.
So what do you mean by verticals now?
Okay. So it originated in China, right?
Uh-huh.
And a vertical is really shot for a phone. So normally when the stuff that we work on is shot what we call 16:9, right? Which is like 9 high and 16 wide. But the vertical is 9 wide and 16 long, right? So because it's meant for people who just want to hold their phone like this, right? And not have to flip it to the side. So, and it's mostly like, right now it's mostly like soap opera kind of stuff. Like, you know, I married my
Korean dramas or stuff? Yeah, like, what are we talking about here?
It's like, they come up with titles like, you know, I married, you know, my sister's cousin, or, you know, just weird stuff, right? It's like,
okay.
They come up with all kind of names, right?
But, like, you know, Japanese anime with their hugely long titles.
They just come up with that. So, but it's super popular. It's catching on. Now all the big studios are looking to get into verticals.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah.
And I guess a lot of sound goes along with that. So, especially for phones. So here's a question for you. Mm-hmm. What's the difference between designing sound for like a movie theater or a screen at home, which I guess at this point is basically a computer with a monitor,
right,
or a phone, because there's got to be different sensibilities for designing sound.
Yeah, well, technically, I would say the simplest way to explain it is that, okay, there's something called, there's a loudness standards, right, as far as how loud things are supposed to be. So,
and where in the track they're supposed to be, right?
Yeah, and most stuff like in a theater, right, we've got 5-1, 7-1 at most, you know, on a phone or a, you know, to MacBook or, you know, something like that, you really are limited to stereo for the most part, right? And typically stuff, say for instance for YouTube, is actually a lot louder than what you would play for a theater, right? The loudness standard is a lot louder. So for instance, let's say a television show, I might mix it to what they call minus 24, which is an integrated level, meaning that as you play the entire project, it averages minus 24 dB. But for a YouTube project, I might be at minus 16, minus 18, right? So I'm 6 to 8 dB hotter on those devices.
Yeah. Hi, I'm Daniel Hook. I am a sound and interaction designer and researcher, and also co-head of the sound design master program at Zurich University of the Arts in Switzerland. And you're listening to the Audio Branding Podcast. This is a great place to learn about the power of sound. And if you want to understand how to harness that power in your own life, keep listening.
What does that do to dialogue? And I'm asking you this because I know there have been many jokes about this when it comes to Christopher Nolan, but the dialogue that people are listening to in things now is so muffled and hard to hear as opposed to everything sound-wise that's going on around it.
Right.
That's why a lot of people put on their closed captions.
Right.
When they're watching YouTube or when they're watching a film on their television or when they're watching it on their computer, you know?
Right. Well, I would say probably because what happens is you're taking, like, say, for instance, in this room I'm in now, it's a 914 mixed room. And so if I'm taking all of this information that is surrounding me, that's coming from the ceiling, and I'm pushing that to stereo, right, it's going to kind of overpower the dialogue a little bit. So I think, for me, I think you have to mix for the environment that you're in. And you really need to be able to have a reference for that. So say for instance, if I'm mixing for a phone, right? I'm gonna mix in this room, but then I'm gonna play it back on a phone, right? And that way I can hear what's happening with the dialogue, what's happening with the backgrounds, what's happening with the effects, and I can make adjustments. You know, and I think that's what needs to happen. And I think a lot of times people don't do that. They don't play it back, you know, in the medium that it's meant to be played on. They just play it in the room and it sounds fantastic, right?
Yeah.
But then when you squash it all down to a stereo file, it will sound different.
Yeah, I was going to ask you what people could do to get that dialogue a little more clear in productions,
well,
but yeah.
it starts with the mix. Yeah, I mean, you have to do it in the mix. Like, I mixed a show for Paramount, and we actually mixed the whole show on a television. We fed into the television, right? All the channels into the television. And that way, they wanted to know what it would sound like on a TV, on like a, it was a 42-inch TV. I remember it. It's been a few years ago. They were, that 42 was big back then, right? It's not so big now.
No, but not, I mean,
so, yeah. So
still
that was
big.
But that was our mixed reference, right? Because we wanted to make sure that it sounded good on that TV. And we also streamed it simultaneously to the producer's laptop, right? So he could hear what it sounds like on his laptop. He could hear what it sounds like coming from the TV. Because the speakers that we have in the studio, I mean, they're top-of-the-line speakers. They're going to sound fantastic in the studio.
Of course, right? But not everyone has those.
Right. Then the other thing that's important is that the room be tuned. right?
Ah, okay. So how does one tune a room?
Well, I call in Adobe used to do it. They've kind of like got out of that business and now it's more independence. But they come in the room with this equipment and they monitor every speaker, right? Because the idea it really is to make the room flat for us. We don't want peaks and valleys, you know, in the audio, because that'll give us, you know, like say for instance, that there's a dip in the low end, right, and the room hasn't been compensated, we're gonna push the low end, which means that possibly when it gets to another playback format, the bass is gonna be like really loud. So we try to mix in a neutral environment where everything is flat, and that also allows us to really hear distinctly what's going on, right?
So you're talking about flat, though. You're not talking about dead.
No.
Dead
yeah,
is
I'm talking,
different.
Yeah,
right?
Dead is different.
Yeah.
Flat means...
Because that's what I have in the booth there. Yeah, it's like dead.
Yeah, no. Flat is like there are no resonant frequencies. There's everything is as equal as you can get it. It kind of, there's a curve, right? That there's like a 12 dB drop off at around 2000, but everything else is kind of like you're trying to get it as flat as you can, meaning there's no frequencies that are popping up. None are louder than the others.
That right? makes sense.
Yeah,
definitely. Yeah. This has been part one of our interview. I hope you'll tune in next week for part two. Well, that's the end of this episode. Thanks for listening. And if you like what you heard, why not tell a friend about this podcast? It's available in all the usual locations. Until next time.